Live and learn. Welcome to season 2 of our weekly conversations about living, learning, teaching, and intercultural communication. We discuss cultural awareness and diversity, education and mentality, and we never really know where our talk will bring us in each episode. So, we just follow our curiosity and invite you to join us. In this episode, we invite you to join our discussion of resilience. We discover the role of self-actualization, alertness, collaboration, and support for the development of resilience. Listen to the end and get a resilience mantra as a bonus. Change your perspective and see what you can do being resilient, developing resilient reactions in order to achieve the goal.
It's not social distancing, it's social connectivity and physical distancing.
Collaboration, seeing a bigger picture and wishing to achieve a goal.
Me. Right now, with all my skills, with all my experience and knowledge that I have, being fit and ready, whatever I am right now, I believe I can solve this problem.
Creativity grows on free soil, while resilience grows on hardship. Making work part of life, and it is an important part of life. It is something that we cherish, really. It is something that we need, not only for earning a living, but also for self-development, what do we call it?
Protecting yourself, taking care of yourself.
I mean, work as self-fulfillment as well, and a space in which you are yourself as a professional and you present yourself to others as a professional. And this is an important part of life, but then other parts of life are as important. At some points, get more important when you underestimate how valuable they are actually. And just a quiet walk in the woods is no less important than a good and fulfilling working day.
You know, what you are saying reminded me of Maslow. When we are working for survival, when we are working for gaining some appreciation and professional reputation, and when we are working for self-actualization, right?
Exactly.
And in the word self-actualization, a big part of the word is the word self. So you need to have something to actualize. Right, so this self should be a healthy thing to present, because just as we mentioned in one of our quotes, that you cannot pour out of an empty cup. So the very same thing here, your self should be well-rounded and well-cherished in order to be actualized in the end.
If you mention Maslow pyramid, it's even simpler. As soon as the basic levels are satisfied, then in the end you can come to self-actualization. It's natural development. And then if you are self-actualizing, you cannot actually get back and think, oh, and now I need to satisfy my basic needs. No, it doesn't work like that. You just don't come to self-actualization if your basic needs are not satisfied.
Can I ask you a question? If, for example, we're developing ourselves and then there is a point at which you need to, like, a drastic point in the life or in the environment when you need to suddenly come back to the lower level. Does it mean that you are further away from this tip? If you need
it's just not the most important need now, because it's the pyramid of needs. So your need for food is always higher in the hierarchy than your need for self-actualization. You can suppress, I can imagine, your need for food and still go on self-actualizing. This can happen and has happened. In the Holocaust times, we have a lot of evidence to this, when the need, the basic needs were not satisfied and were suppressed, and people still went on self-actualizing.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that normally, if your basic needs are not satisfied, your need for protection, your need for food, your need for shelter. So these are the basic needs. As soon as they are satisfied, you can go on to new higher needs on this hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
I would put it so. But then as soon as you come to some point, you develop a need for self-development, then you develop a need for self-actualization. I believe as soon as you feel this need, then it's so hard, or can be hard, for a human to cut down on it. But then when some critical moments come and your need for food or for shelter is actualized more than your need for self-development, then you need somehow to balance these things, or to work hard to first satisfy your basic needs in order to get back to satisfying the higher ones.
You mentioned Holocaust or the war periods when there is this vital threat, right? This existential, not so even the existential. It is interesting that I think different cultures and different nations have very different experience in this and different memory that passes on to new, younger generations. But anyhow, do you think that this experience builds up in, I don't know, in the narratives that we were told and we were taught through stories?
Definitely so. The short answer would be yes, definitely so. The longer answer is, let's go and read all the books, all the evidence that tells all sorts of stories that then go down from generation to generation. When you cook, you now in 2020, living in comfortable conditions, having all the ingredients you need. When you cook, your cooking, and I know that for sure, your cooking is a piece of art. But of course, you keep these memories and the stories of people in your family who survived through the war.
Mm-hmm.
And these stories of eating everything that is on your plate, you have to eat everything, because people who transmit these stories suffered famine. There wasn't anything to eat. And somehow, of course, I believe this is part of any family story of a person who keeps the memory. And after 3-4 generations, it's not easy to forget and shouldn't be forgotten. And still, when you cook and make your dish a piece of art, you are no longer satisfying your need for food. You're satisfying your need for self-actualization, for creativity, with, of course, the background that all of us keep still.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think?
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant, and thank you for going from the example that we had already discussed, you know, this family story of mine. But yeah, this is something that I wanted to say. Being exposed to difficulties, to hardships, to lack of something, to wars, does it build up the readiness to react? Does it mean specific conditions that other people just do not have because they do not have it in their narrative DNA? Is this where the resilience comes from? Because right now it has become one of the top words during the COVID. And the biggest discussion is here that this is the first global hardship that a lot of people have experienced for the first time, you know, in the first level in the prosperous countries. Because the Second World War is far away, like my grandparents were a part of it, and of course the famine, the Holodomor, was a part of our everyday discussion if I didn't want to eat the last piece of little bread or something. But it's not necessarily the same situation, for example, here, or 500 kilometers from here, or 5,000 kilometers from here. So it would be a very different exposure to this experience, I guess.
I don't know what to say. I'm thinking and trying to get whether resilience is opposite to creativity in some ways. Like you develop resilience if you had been exposed to these hardships or you have them as part of your family history. And on the contrary, you develop creativity if you have a different narrative that you can do everything, that there are all the conditions, there are all the conditions for your free self-realization. Are they somehow different, or is creativity part of resilience that helps overcome some problems, some difficulties? My first idea is that creativity grows on free soil while resilience grows on hardship.
When you're talking about this, the first idea that came to my mind is the Anne Frank's diaries. And, well, is this creativity? That's kind of a question, but the person chose to put this into the letters, put everyday life into something that helped her to survive longer. And I think there are so many famous and less famous and known and unknown examples of it. But yeah, in order to be talking about this, let's go a little bit scientific method. Let's come with the idea of what resilience is as it is. Because when we are talking about it, we need to be in the same terms and on the same page. So let's first start with that, if our dialogue goes to the resilience. And it's been such a buzzword in 2020. I don't know, no conference goes without it. No discussion, no speaker, no keynote, from what I have experienced over this Zoom time, they just do not start speaking without this word. It comes from physics. It comes from the physics of materials. Because this is the ability or the feature of any material to bounce back and coming back to the form. So basically, I don't know if you just Google or Wikipedia.
The noun resilience, meaning the act of rebounding, was first used in the 1620s and was derived from resilience, the present participle of Latin resilire, to recoil or rebound. By 1824, the term had developed to encompass the meaning of elasticity.
This is the physical, the real thing from the physical world. So when I first heard it and asked, so what exactly is this, how different it is from elasticity, I was given an example of a tennis ball. When you hit the tennis ball and it, for example, hits the wall, so it changes completely its form, has the ability to bounce back and come back to its form. Mm-hmm. So what actually makes the process of bounce impossible? And that's why if you just hit the stone, it wouldn't bounce back. And the funny thing that, because in this notion, you need at least two objects and action, right? This added power. So basically, when we're talking about the resilience, we're talking about something that hits and the surface that stands up or doesn't stand up after it's been hit. And depends, of course, on the power which was applied to this, again, depending how you throw your ball at the wall, what your ball is made of, what your wall is made of. And then this is, again, the physics. But then it grew up to the psychological term, and this psychological term is called, again, psychological resilience. And this is the ability of the person psychic to stabilize back after the stress. This is basically what not being a ball, but being a wall. In this situation, we're talking of the surface and being able to survive after it was hit by conditions.
So do you mean in psychological resilience, a person is not an object being thrown, but rather a wall being thrown against?
Well, because you have...
Can be both.
Can be both, but in this concept, you have three things. You have the object which is thrown, the power by which it was thrown, the third person, right? Mm-hmm. Or abstract thing, and the wall on which it hits. And because we're talking about how the crisis hit me, so mm-hmm. I think it's not me hitting the crisis, right?
It can be me thrown in circumstances that are critical or traumatic as well.
That's why both of these elements, subject and object, should have the necessary resilience to survive after the collision, after it was collided.
In communication, I would rather put it like this, like you're saying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a crisis coming to society, to a person's life, I wouldn't put it in terms of subject-object like this, but rather changing conditions and then the ability or developing a capability to react elastically, let's put it so, in order to be able to get back to this pre-crisis state. Like mm-hmm. to calm down. If we take a very simple situation, something unexpected happens. You live like you live, then something unexpected happens. You react in some way, and this way can be destructive or can be resilient. Mm-hmm. So if it is destructive, then you react aggressively, or you react in a depressive way, or you react in any other non-constructive way, then it's very hard to get back to calm down and get back to this pre-crisis condition of yours. If you react resiliently, you react in a way which allows you, after this critical situation goes by, to get back to a condition you were in before it happened.
Yeah, so when we're talking, of course, so when we're talking about resilience, it's like the feature, right, of what? Of your psyche to get concentrated and meet the critical situation. And when it goes by, to come back to a normal stage. And that's why actually we were talking in the last episodes about going back to normal. This is why we're talking about it right now, about the COVID, post-COVID. Like, are we going back to normal?
Can we go back to normal?
Or we shouldn't go back to normal as like an education, like when we're talking about the online education. So what was normal is not something we are going back to. But I think this new normal thing, which I guess will be the word of the year in 2020, it's either COVID or new normal or resilience, actually, by the way. So that would be definitely top 10. It all comes back from this notion, from this concept of being hit and survive.
Yeah, and develop or already have as pre-settings now, as basic settings, to have this capability to react appropriately, I would say. And appropriately here means adequate to the situation, not too much, not too little. Like if somebody knocks on my door, my adequate reaction or appropriate reaction would be to come and ask who's there. But if it disturbs me so much that I cannot continue talking to you and I don't know what to do, how to react to this knock at the door, like, this is not appropriate reaction. This does not let me get back to normal after this situation goes by. But if I react appropriately, then I don't even perceive the situation as critical in this case. In more complicated cases, a flight being canceled, like many people experienced during this recent crisis, and not knowing whether you can get back home or see your relatives or get back to work, then appropriate reaction would be making more important decisions, and you need to be, if not calm, ready to react and ready to make decisions. So you need to be what? Let's discuss what are these features a person needs to have in order to react to a crisis or to a critical situation appropriately.
Remember this question. If my answer will go very far from it, please remind me of it, because while you were talking, I thought that I came up with the very first fairy tale about resilience. Well, the way you were describing this knocking on the door, I thought of the fairy tale of three piglets, because they were hit by the critical situation, right? The wolf was coming. They were not prepared, and they were building up their resilience and building better house every time to be able to protect themselves against this critical situation, against the wolf. So...
And they were, let's get back to Maslow pyramid, they were on basic needs level.
Yeah.
The need for protection.
Yes.
Yes. And so on every level of this pyramid of needs, also it is important and possible to be resilient as regards this level.
And what we were told during the COVID right now, that the very first thing that helps to stay healthy and sane is collaboration. And what they did, the three piglets, they actually did collaborate one with another.
And they were creative. That's why they succeeded. Cool.
Yeah, so that is kind of something that we get from the very early age, right? Young age, to have how to build up the skill. If you don't have any protection and you do not have enough resources to build immediately the best solution, that it's still you have a chance to survive by building it up.
It's so cool you mention it now, and that can be the answer to the question you asked in the beginning. So what do prosperous cultures and countries then do if they hadn't experienced traumatic experiences in recent generations? They tell stories, they tell fairy tales to further generations. This is how you keep the memory of something traumatic that can or might happen. And this is how you teach young kids to react. You give examples with fairy tales so they know how to be collaborative, how to be creative, how to find a way out of a difficult situation. It's so smart.
Yeah, it is. And the wisdom of the folklore. So yeah, you were asking about what constitutes resilience, right? And we can try and think of various subcategories, the ones that overlap one another, I guess. So I wouldn't say it's 1, 2, 3, 4, and they have their separate sectors. But this is something that the bigger or the larger the overlapping is, So the more structured would be and more protected or stable it might be. So I would probably start with the very idea of the factors that influence or that can be distinguished when we're talking about the resilience. And we started with the self-actualization, like you really need to have the self taken care of.
Yeah, but not only, because we somehow misinterpreted self-actualization. And if we get back to seeing that you can be resilient, satisfying the needs of different levels of the pyramid of needs, so then you can be resilient if you are even very far from self-actualization.
Mm-hmm.
And still, what do you need to have to be resilient, to be able to calm down a critical or traumatic situation?
That's actually one of the examples that we had given to the 21st century skills for educators, is when we're talking about all the hardship we need to survive, all the new situations, all the new regulations, all the new obstacles. We need not to forget about taking care of ourselves, to taking care of our resource, being in a good, proper state of mind, state of body, physical shape, and state of, readiness to react, I guess, having this...
Alertness, no, being ready to action.
Yes, being ready to...
Yeah, alertness actually means being ready to act.
This is me. This is what I have. And depending on in which state I am, I can react very differently. Like being prepared, being ready, being alert, being sane, being physically fit, mentally active. So what do I have in order to start reacting on whatever comes? So I think this is the first thing. The second one, I would probably put having this collaboration, having this peer support, having family support, having professional support, all this social connections, bounds, connectivity, and with the social distancing that became, again, a top 10 words of 2020, I really like the slogan that it's not social distancing, it's social connectivity and physical distancing that is needed. Connectivity and knowing that you are not alone, knowing that you are part of a bigger social group, knowing that you have support, receiving this support, and being able to ask for this support. Yeah, a lot of people, I guess, might have problems with the very idea of asking for support, asking for help, asking to talk. In this case, I think being ready to collaborate, to get connected, to be a part of a bigger social group, always, like the history shows that being a part of a social group helps you to survive than alone. Like standing alone doesn't help to survive.
Yeah, so the feeling of belonging as well, that is protective, that can save. So social support that is closely connected to the feeling of belonging. If I really feel I belong to the group, then I probably feel it's much easier to ask for help because I belong. I know I can call this group we. And together we can do something. But if it's me and the others, then it's much harder to ask for help and all those mm-hmm. things that you mentioned come.
Okay, so we can probably paraphrase it to belong to a cultural group, right? Because that can be anything, that can be social, professional, age, whatever. So it is...
Yeah, belonging somewhere.
Belonging to people who share the same culture, so you feel one of them. Yeah, so social group. I think this is the second factor.
I can definitely say about myself, I don't belong. Yeah, and this is, in short, the description of like, where are you from? Oh, that's the hardest question. For some people, it's so easy when they belong to a social group, to a nation, to a professional group. Then it's easier to say, who are you? What are you? Where are you from? When I am asked this question, and I think we also spoke about that before, where are you from? I cannot say. I can start enumerating where I've lived, where I've studied, which languages I speak, and I belong partially to all the communities.
Which constitute your identity, which build up to your identity.
Which I can partially relate to, which in some points resonates with me, or which I resonate with in some points, and then again, not in everything.
Yeah, but because in different situations, you can refer to different social groups. That's why we are building different social groups during the life, belong to them or join them, because we want to have to know how to deal with my trauma after a sports event. And that's why I belong to people who can give me the support and saying what was their experience. But I wouldn't be asking them how to go through professional hardship if I am in a completely different field. So that's why we have these different groups where we can ask for knowledge, ask for help, ask for experience, right? So that's why we are building up multiple social connections.
Well, this is something that I personally feel as the hardest thing to do, to feel, to build. That's getting personal.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I really try to associate myself with the different groups, communities, and so on, because it just helps me to feel a little bit more stable. You know, like this proverb, never hold your eggs in one basket?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. I know it sounds like a bit cynical, but in the long run, that is what helps me. For example, if I had to relocate, so half of my connections have stayed where they are. So I'm not there any longer. I'm not a part of their frequent meetings and so on. So this is something that I cannot carry. However, there are some others that I still do relate to, and I'm still a part of something. So like this rerouting doesn't feel a completely new process, because we still have the connections.
Okay, yeah, I think for me it's much more replanting. Yeah, okay, as you're into gardening, you can use this metaphor and have all the right to do so. And as I'm, as we also mentioned, much more individualistic, I believe, I get really tired of building many different social connections. I don't like belonging to many groups. This is something that I find not only tiring, exhausting for myself. And for me, it's much easier to just take myself and reroute and take myself with me. I'm okay with that. Instead of building multiple social connections. Mm-hmm. That's how we're different, and it's beautiful.
That's diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then the next one. So like, who I am, what do I have, was the first one. Who is with me? Who is with me to help me? Who we are was the second idea. And then what actually do we have to solve? What is the problem? So I think then we're coming to the ability to understand, to assess, to predict, to get prepared to the very critical situation. So either it is, I don't know, a job change, relocation, COVID, pandemics, whatever hits. So being able to understand what it is, And I think this is why in March everybody was so frustrated and started talking about resilience, because there was not much information of what is coming and how to get protected. And everybody was laughing that all you can do is just washing your hands. And that didn't really help some areas and a lot of people, because it already hit. I don't know, maybe learning from the experience of others. And I think the countries which were hit later could already use the experience of the countries that were hit earlier. But all the same, it can be related to other examples. So basically, the active problem solving and, you know, scientific method helps here. The relevant instruments of diagnostics, of assessment, of application, what to apply, where instrument, where to apply. And the weirdest things is just trying to use shamanic rituals to fight the COVID. That was so frustrating. That means that not everybody is ready to react adequately to the problems using the scientific problem solving methods
and critical thinking,
which is tops of the top.
Yeah, like you get some information, and if you're used to getting information, analyzing it, doing fact checking, etc., if you're used to working with information, seeing a social media post, you can already say, just from a preview, whether this information is taken from a reliable source, more or less, whether it's even worth being checked. And then something that is worth being checked should be checked. Critical thinking should be used, of course. And then it helps to develop your resilience. If you want to understand what the crisis, trauma, problem really is, and then you do some work, you analyze, you get to know your facts, and then you make your decisions that are already like scientifically based and thought over.
We have already established readiness to know what we are fighting against, mm-hmm. then I guess the next factor is a very important thing to understand what for, right? So what is the, why are we fighting it? Like, what is the main purpose? What are the stakes? Are we here to teach present simple, or are we here to teach communication? Can we see the bigger picture? Can we see the purpose and so on? And for example, the COVID goes and everybody goes online. We discussed this in the online education episode already. But the idea, like, oh, I cannot do it, I'm not going to do it, everybody will be laughing at me. Again, try, if we're putting the purpose and the meaning of what we're doing, we're here to teach, to share knowledge, to help people to gain their qualifications, and to build up the further generation of qualified, critically thinking and resilient generation for us to move forward, that's completely different. That changes the perspective immediately.
Yeah, then being able to see whether what's happening is a problem that you need to react however adequately to, or is it a symptom? Many teachers complain about poor behavior of their students in class, and especially during online lessons when teachers don't know yet how to react as a teacher. Like, what can you do? Can you just reject or deny access to this student next time? Or like, what are you going to do as a teacher? How are you going to control, punish, I don't know, whatever. then if you see poor behavior, as they say, not as a problem, but as a symptom of something that is changing, then change your perspective and see what you can do, being resilient, developing resilient reactions in order to achieve the goal, not your personal goal of not being disturbed during the lesson as a teacher, but seeing a bigger picture and achieving a bigger and more important goal of giving your students skills that they are in your lesson for. So seeing the bigger picture and keeping goals in mind with a bigger perspective, always understanding, or at least trying to ask yourself this question, what's going on? Is this a problem or is this a symptom that says something very important that can be essential for the whole course? If we talk about higher education as well, students who may seem dissatisfied with what is happening. And as a teacher, it's very hard to assess in the moment of teaching. You want to be giving more and more information, and then you feel that something is wrong or not as right as you want it to, or the process doesn't flow as smoothly as you want it to or as you expected it to. If it's a symptom of the students, let's say, curiosity, they want to know more, but maybe as a teacher, you don't give enough space for them to express their needs. So then their discomfort and some signs of something that doesn't go right can give you a hint that you might wish to change something and give them more space for expressing their needs. And then you will see the course will go much better, way better, than if you thought of this as a problem and tried to solve it. Just listen to me, just be attentive. This is the course I'm delivering. And then let's get back again to collaboration. If there are two sides to this situation, students and teachers, both in at school and at higher education institutions and in individual studies. The same, I believe, is happening everywhere. If you are ready to be resilient and if you are ready to react, taking into consideration what's going on the other part, then collaboration in search for better results of this course can bring really good fruit. Collaboration, seeing a bigger picture and wishing to achieve a goal.
And I guess in all of what you're saying, there is this very clear belief and trust in yourself as professional, belief and trust in yourself as a adequate person, as a person who can solve such problems, who has the experience to solve whatever problems come. And again, I'm trying to make the parallel with a bigger crisis like the COVID we had over here, and with the everyday resilience that we need to build as communicators, as educators. And I remember that everybody was so overwhelmed in March, right? Everybody was so panicky. Everybody was scared to collapse. Everybody was trying to speak about the crisis, the financial crisis, the inability to solve, that everybody will be just dying in the hospitals. I think this is everything that says that we are on the, you know, this red zone of challenge. That means that it's a bit too much that we expect, rather than we expected. It's a bit over something that as society we had an experience to deal with. And that means if we come back to our educational everyday routines, that means that too much, being overwhelmed and being panicky, is a sign that maybe the balance was not there. maybe there was too much of learning, or too much of stress, or too much of preparation, or too much of material, or you are asking yourself too much as a teacher. You know, this perfectionism hits you, or there might be so many different reasons for it, but the very idea of having trust in yourself that you can solve this problem can help you to see strengths and capacity. So basically that phenomenal positive outlook, yes, I can, I'll just do it. This is so difficult to do.
Yeah, like what are you based on when you say, yeah, I can do it? How do you know you can? How do you know you can do it? Have you got corresponding experience? If you have, then it really gives you much strength. You can really trust yourself because you know that you've already done that before. This is trust based on experience. And this is the best form of trust, I think. If you've never tried before, how can you know? Like, I like that joke. Can you play the piano? I don't know. I've never tried. Why does it make us laugh?
We normally say, no, I don't.
Normally we say, no, I don't, if we haven't tried before. But in situations like, I can do it. How do you know? Have you tried before? And there are two ways. If you have tried before, you have got this experience, and then you can trust yourself and you have this basic trust. Or other people have continuously been telling you, you can do it. I trust in you. And this is also important. That's why this social support that you appreciate and use so much is helpful when other people say, you belong to our group as professionals. You can do it. I trust in you. And then you can be fed by this support and try to do something even if you have never tried before. But if you don't have this basic trust, how can you say without, well, kind of cheating yourself, I can do it, and then really not feeling this capacity to react, to do, to achieve, etc. And this is something to learn, to be taught. I don't know. How and when do you think we learn this capacity to react resiliently?
Through everyday stress, from our very first contact with the outer world. Yesterday, I sent to a friend of mine who has a small daughter the article about the first interactions in the sandbox. And she says, oh, this is so right in the moment because this is what I am scared of. Not necessarily the kid is scared of. This is where growth comes from, your everyday first steps, going from the child and, you know, collaborating one with another. Somebody comes and gets your toy. How do you react? Do you run? Do you cry? Do you show aggressiveness? But then the question is, if the kid is very much protected, like, will he or she, will they be able to react in an adequate way the next time? Will they be suppressing others later in the future? Will they be too much aggressive later in the future because they didn't learn this balance in the very first interactions? And this is a question. We all come from our childhood. And the question is, how much did we have to deal with? Was it an easy, comfortable zone for learning? Was it like going out of the comfort zone and feeling that it's all right, I can do it, and I can come back home safe, I can still be protected by parents, school, I don't know, teachers, whatever, you can scale it wherever you want. Or was I scared, panicked, overwhelmed, and something was too much, and now I have a traumatic experience? So I think day by day, that's why we have the classes. We learned class by class, discipline by discipline, in a growing way, specifically because we need to be able to have the adequate power to react.
It's not the only way to learn class by class. Yeah, there can be some other ways, not less efficient.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that being ready to embrace the new challenge and remembering that I here today with all my experience, skills and knowledge believe, have a positive outlook that I'm able to do this, to solve this problem that is coming to me with the help of everybody else if I need it, in order to go through the situation and life sane, more professional, and so on. So the meaning and purpose. So basically, what I just did, I just put all these five factors that we described into one resilience mantra.
So instead of saying just to your mirror reflection, I can do it, we should use all this mantra, which makes more sense if you think deeply into what there is behind each phrase there. And then step by step, develop this skill of resilience, of reacting appropriately to the stress that comes. And yeah, also be sure the stress will come. We cannot just live.
Get prepared.
We need to get prepared to some, and we may be prepared to some like realistic stresses that, like, okay, when I'm hungry, I might have some emotional problems. Yeah, but I know that. So I try not to be hungry. And I know the feeling of hunger will come if I don't eat. Or if I lack an hour, 2 hours of sleep, I will not be able most probably to react resiliently to some stress that comes. And these are some of the things that I can predict. So these are predictable stress moments. Lack of sleep, lack of food, lack of social support. And then we can go further. Lack of feeling of protection and so on and so forth.
Lack of trust.
Lack of trust
in yourself. Lack of trust in the others.
So what do we need to do? We need to fill...
I will repeat the mantra.
Yeah, sure. Please do.
Me, right now, with all my skills, with all my experience and knowledge that I have, being fit and ready, whatever I am right now, I believe I can solve this problem because I can categorize it and put it into the solvable chunks. With the help of others, because I have the higher meaning and higher purpose, what I want to do further with it.
Proper time to say live and learn, be resilient, repeat your mantra daily, feel the resource if you lack something, and get back to us for our next episode. Also, follow us on our social media, live and learn.
Learn and live.